We're all here to do what we're all here to do.
Chris in Tennessee, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. Gonna stand my ground, won't be turned around, and I'll keep this world from dragging me down. Gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Revere Radio Network. My name's Chris. I'm happy to be here with you guys. I really am happy to be here with you guys this week. I didn't have a show last week. It was mainly because we had just started back on the road with the band and trying to get the schedule adjusted again back to the old schedule that we've been doing for years here on the road, and then finding time to do the show, which is nothing new. It's easy to do. It's just had to get adjusted to it. It kind of caught me off guard. We had a month off, which is rare and fun. We all got our batteries recharged and everything, so just kind of took a little bit to get readjusted to it, but I think we're back in the saddle again. I wish I had that song. I could play that. I should have played that for the intro. Anyway, I don't know. As far as format on the show goes, I think, there's never really any format ever on the show. If you've ever listened to the archives, you can tell, like, one show will be, like, highly produced show with commercials and songs and, you know, a lot of stuff, and the next one will be nothing like it, you know, just talking with no production value whatsoever. I don't really do that by design. It just kind of happens, whatever. I don't know. There's no set format. And I think it's good. I think it may be frustrating for some people. But what I guess I'm getting at that is I wanted to try to do a few different things with format and just to look for in the future. One thing that I think is going to be an integral part of the situation is these show notes that I've been trying to do the last few weeks. And that's basically just a description of every show written out and having links to the things I may have mentioned during the course of the show, even if I don't expressly say, hey, check the show notes. Sometimes I'll go through it, or I have been the last few weeks, and going through it and finding things that I talked about that people may want to link to, and then I'll put it there. And you can find that at the nowheretorun.podomatic.com site, the nowheretorun.podomatic.com site, and that's kind of the home base usually for servers and everything else. That's where I put it on that goes to iTunes and all the other stuff. So you can go to that site and you can review the show notes if there's any particular thing that I say that you may want to take a look at. What else? There was some other format thing. I don't know. Oh, yeah. What I think I'm going to start doing is at the end of every show, I may play a clip that takes another hour. Like, some of these shows might end up being 2 hours long, but I don't know. I think I'm just going to start providing or playing more clips of things that I think would be of interest to people. So the shows may be a lot longer, but at the end, I mean, it may end up being a longer show. But again, there's no set in stone format, so it's almost a moot point to really go into much of that. Okay, I think that's pretty much it. Also, I'd like to encourage people to keep me in check with your emails. If you hear anything that I say that is wrong, or you think is wrong, or you're just unhappy about that I am going down that road or whatever, please email me at chris@conspiracyclothes.com and let me know, because, I mean, it's just me here, you know. When I hit the upload button, I mean, I didn't have anybody checking me, you know. I don't have any checks and balances, and it's kind of beyond praying for it. I do pray, you know, before the shows not to give out any disinformation and to you know, be on track with God's will. So, but I and encourage you again. That's how you support this show, is to pray for me for the same thing, for God's will to be done. And I really do need your emails, too, because I could be, I mean, I don't know. I mean, the material that I cover a lot is just so out there that it needs, I need to hear people say, like, that's not right. I don't feel it's right. And then it encourages me to check it because, I mean, like I said, I'm just unchecked here. I don't really, like, show the show to anybody, you know. I mean, my girlfriend downloads them and listens to them, and if something's, like, crazy, she'll say, like, you know, I don't think that's right or whatever. And if she says it, then it's probably right. So, anyway, I just wanted to get that out there. Okay, let's get started with the show. I'm going to go down some of my notes that I've been writing. They're going to seem totally unrelated, and that's because they are totally unrelated, but here we go. One is, number one is bathroom graffiti. I know I've talked a lot about the wonders of bathroom graffiti before, but I just rekindled my love affair with it when I was on the road this past week, so I just wanted to let you guys know we should be winning the bathroom graffiti information war because, okay, number one, there is no repercussions for writing on a bathroom stall wall. I mean, people write the most stupid, vulgar things on there, and it's always like, this illustrates how easy it is to get away with it. I mean, because people write the most revealing things on there, stuff that they would never tell anybody ever, that they will let the bathroom stall wall know all about it. And so I think that, you know, you have this anonymity that comes with it, and so anybody that would not be a type of person to hand out a DVD or something or actually do anything like talking about it to somebody can be even more bold in that scenario. And, you know, I think the big thing is you have this incredibly captive audience in a bathroom stall. I mean, people are concentrating pretty heavily in a bathroom stall, and it really does plant a seed in the sense that, you know, people are looking at that and they're thinking about, like, what I write on it is this kind of, I don't know, if it's just it's about four lines. It says, 9/11 was an inside job. The Bill of Rights is dead. Beware the North American Union, PrisonPlanet.com. And I think PrisonPlanet.com works because it's a good site to send them to, and it also has this connotation of Prison Planet, and it kind of makes all three of the other ones tie together. But you can write anything, but having something for people to really think about and for it not just to be some kind of wacky thing, I think is interesting. But as a planting seed factor, it was also let people know to do that themselves, you know, especially if they already thought any of that stuff, they would say, you know what, I could probably write something on the bathroom wall or whatever, but, you know, I bet you could make so much of a difference just by everybody keeping a Sharpie on them at all times. If you just, they have these little Sharpies that you can put on your key ring, and they're just like half Sharpies, and you can buy them like in four packs that just like have these little keychain rings. If you just had one of those on you, just made a point to have one in case you went to any bathroom, and, you know, maybe not a bathroom that you go to all the time or whatever, but, you know, bathrooms that you're just going to be in and out of. Like I said, I'm at truck stops all over the country all the time, so I get to really spread the message. In fact, there's a high probability that you will see that message on a truck stop bathroom wall if you live anywhere in the Southeast. You will probably run into that. Okay, let's see here. I guess that's pretty much all I had to say about bathroom graffiti. But I really do think it is something that can make a difference. You know, it just brings this kind of thing out of the internet and into the real world. Which reminds me of I saw a lot of Ron Paul banners and stuff. I was in I think it was in Greenville, South Carolina. I don't know. I think it was in there. But a lot of Ron Paul Revolution signs everywhere, just all over the city. It was really, really good to see that people are, you know, I think that has been postulated before. If they do shut down the internet, it'll bring all these people that are keyboard patriots out in the real world, you know. They're going to start their hanging banners off of streets and doing things that are going to wake up people. It would backfire if you took all these patriots off the internet. You know, at least with the internet, it keeps them at bay. It keeps them in their house looking at a computer screen. Which reminds me of something that I think this is a really good idea. And it's so good, in fact, it's dangerous for me to say, I think, because it could really, really make a difference. And that is, if you are a DVD burner, which again, I really highly, highly recommend burning DVDs, or in One thing, just a quick thing before I get into the most dangerous suggestion is, well, I've been burning a lot of DVDs and handing them to our local. We got like a used CD store, and I know the owner. Let's say that. And so anyway, I give him tons and tons of DVDs. It's like a really good distribution center for Truth Movies, because he just gives them away, and he's really, you know, passionate about it as well. But one thing I was going to say, I mean, I also give them to people at grocery stores when I see them have, you know, drinking Diet Cokes, or when they have babies, I'll give them the vaccine / fluoride combo uppercut punch. But anyway, so what I think that could be done is, if you burned maybe 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 DVDs on various topics that you feel are the most important, and getting mailers like those mailers, you know, that are just the perfect size for that, and mail them to your local city government. Mail them to every official in your city government. It might be like $100 enterprise, you know, buying the DVDs and the burner and the shipping materials and the shipping costs or whatever. But can you imagine? I mean, that is dangerous talk, you know. If you were the kind of person that would stick a bunch of DVDs in the mail and mail them off and get the addresses of your local, government officials, elected officials and such, I mean, that could really do some serious stuff there. I mean, that is some powerful information that, I mean, because the truth is out there now. I mean, it's just got to be given to the right people. We have the proof of it now. So let's just start waking people up. Okay, before we move on, I have some really interesting stuff to get to here in just a second. This whole show, I got lots of good information for you, so just stick around here with me for a little bit. But before we move on, I want to talk one more thing about the general waking people up and stuff, and one tool that we really, really need to use, and that is our prayer. I think that one thing I've been praying for, and I think together we could really do this, is to pray for, well, you know, I think there's a lot of prominent people out there that are just afraid to speak out about it, you know, that would really, you know, as far as like the Rosie O'Donnell thing, I mean, how many millions of people woke up about that? But there's a particular person that we're waiting on, I'm sure, that is so prominent, and that when he or she comes out about this, it's going to just really, open up the floodgates. And that's the kind of awakening we need to have. I mean, it's so 9/11 is so crucial to quickly get the country to understand about, because we have to understand that the government would do this or we're going to be doomed. And I think that's a tool that God can use. God can use somebody out there. There's the particular prominent person that God is using right now that's going to help this happen. And I think that we can pray for that person and for God's will to be done and for their courage. And I think together we can really make some of this happen. It's a worthy prayer. And in the same way, I think that us together praying for Ron Paul is the type of catalyst that this that needs to happen. We need to pray for God's will to be done in Ron Paul's work. If for nothing else, because if he makes it past the primaries and is able to beat all odds, I mean, beat every odd, they do not want him to win that primary. But, you know, if God's with you, who can be against you? And if our prayers are asking God to be with them, then that's a step in the right direction. And I think that Ron Paul's message being heard will wake people up. You know, when Ron Paul gets an avenue to be talking, then that's the kind of awakening that we need. And it's also the kind of thing that if they make a move on Ron Paul, then they're going to have to deal with a very mad country, because you can fake us out a lot and you can tell us we have things and we don't have things. But when you obviously take a person out of the presidential race for in any way, in any reason, you're going to have an angry mob on your hands. And that's something that this country has for so long not had to deal with. We've been so afraid of our government for so long, and we don't step out and we don't protest, and that's just our training that was, you know, probably instilled in us for a few decades here. Anyway, without going on too much about that, let's just end that segment. We'll take a quick break here. We'll be right back, and we'll get into some real interesting stuff that I know you'll want to hear.
total free speech, even when it's ugly. Revere Radio Network, Tampa.
I'm not going to live by their rules anymore.
Have you ever stood and stared at it, marveled at its beauty, its genius? Billions of people just living out their lives. Oblivious.
Attention, world! Meet my demands or be destroyed!
Take it easy. We are the good guys.
Denial is the most predictable of all human responses.
If I'm not me, who the hell am I?
Okay, it's enough of that. Really, I mean, it's only been, you know, 2 weeks from my last show, so you can't really, you know, play back in the saddle again with any kind of straight face. Okay, I wanted to talk about something that is very interesting, and I hope we get a chance to look at this. I'll put some of this in the show notes. Okay, lately I've been trying to eat and do things, not really wholeheartedly, but just as a general rule, as they did in the Bible. And, you know, specifically with Jesus, I mean, you know, you're told of a few things that he ate and stuff, you know, figs. Apparently he liked figs so much that when a fig tree didn't produce any figs, he cursed it. So, you know, try to find some figs, and it speaks of barley loaf and fish and this kind of thing. So, I mean, it's all good. But so you try to eat like that, or I do anyway. It definitely says not to browbeat anybody for your choosing of how you eat or whatnot. So, because all food is clean now, but not all food is beneficial, as it says. Now, one very, very important part of this is Jesus always gave thanks for the bread and for the wine. And it's just something that it always mentions. And personally, I have taken this ever since I saw this not too long ago, and it just makes so much sense. About something. I'm going to try to tie this together and just kind of work with me here. One thing is this this doctor. His name is Dr. Emoto, and he has, let's see here, Emoto's work, we are provided with factual evidence that human vibrational energy, thoughts, words, ideas, and music affect the molecular structure of water, the very same water that compromises over 70% of the mature human body and covers the same amount of our planet. Water is the very source of all life on this planet, blah, 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 blah. Basically, this guy has done scientific experiments where they have all these specimens of water from different water sources, and they're, you know, real particular about a lot of things as far as that goes, and they do different things. This is a Japanese, I think this is even done in Japan, so they're not Christians per se, but they have these, you know, they'll over a glass of this water or over the droplet of water, they'll do different things. Like, one, they'll say, like, you stupid water, I hate you, water, you're such a bad water, I don't know. And then over one, they'll, like, have a group prayer session, you know, thanking the water and thanking, you know, I don't know, whatever they think there. But basically prayers. I mean, he's using the word prayer. He's very, very in-depth and went through a lot of different things. So there is, you know, and they've done different things to different, I guess, vibrational energies, through both thinking it and not thinking it, praying it, and even just putting words in a jar. Just, they were real thorough. But and then they would freeze the droplets of water immediately and then analyze them over on a microscope. And they had a lot of room for error, you know, and 50 different samples per, you know, and really good stuff. But it does appear that the molecular water energizes to these different crystals and different shapes, and, you know, it's a snowflake type situation where they're just incredibly beautiful, and some of them are tight. They're called clusters, apparently, in this research. But the more pure the idea and intent is of the prayer, the tighter and more beautiful these clusters are, these, you know, beautiful snowflake type structures. But also, like, if you said, here one says, you make me sick, I will kill you, which sounds just like something they'd say in Japan. But then it's just got this awful, you know, non-structured type thing. And what's important about this, and the reason this is tied together, is that I think that there's something to, you know, giving thanks for the bread, and I have a scriptural, you know, and for the wine too. I think that it's very just the way that God works, and has always been, in my view, like a father telling his son, making these rules, or telling their children not to do a certain thing, and their kids and being like, why I want to do that, you know, that doesn't make any sense, but like, just do it, you know, and the parents, in a lot of cases, don't even want to explain to the children why they don't want them to do it, because for a number of reasons. Some the kids just aren't, you know, ready to hear that in some cases, and sometimes just the parents are just lazy and just say, I just said so, that's why, you know. But there's a reason, and I think that even this thanking for bread, it is not just good spiritually and humbly and everything else, but I think that it actually does something to the water and maybe even the wine. I think that to tie quickly, like, as far as grape juice and wine, Edgar Cayce always talked about how incredibly important it was to, if not drink wine, but to drink, you know, real grape juice, red grape juice, and how important it was for your body. And I think that it could be that there is something that maybe grape juice in particular that once you thank God for it and the sacrament type thing. Here, let me just, that it may actually change something in the structure of grape juice that is extremely beneficial for you. And here's a scriptural evidence. Okay, in 1 Corinthians 11 and 20, 29 and 30, 1 Corinthians 11, 29 and 30, this is and he's talking about the sacrament and, you know, eating the bread and drinking the wine and to do it in remembrance of him, and he says that for he that eateth and drinketh unworthily eateth and drinketh damnation to himself, not discerning the Lord's body. For this cause many are weak and sickly among you, and many sleep. And sleep is referred to as death by Paul here in his epistles when people are asking stuff. So he's using sleep as death. So people are getting weak and sickly because they're not doing the sacrament properly. Now, you know, how did Jesus say to do the sacrament? Well, let's see here. In Luke 22, he says, that is, Luke says of Jesus, and he says, and he took the bread and gave thanks and break it. And he gave thanks first. And he break it and gave it unto them, saying, this is my body which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. Likewise, also the cup after supper, saying, this cup is the new testament in my blood, which is shed for you. And in Corinthians it says, this do ye as often as you drink it, in remembrance of me. And so basically, I mean, if you're taking bread, it's really, you know, a great way to thank it, be thankful for it, first of all, and also in this combination of love could be changing it. Here's an interesting part in back to Mr. Momoto here. They asked him the question, have you come across a particular word or phrase in your research that you have found to be most helpful in cleaning up the natural waters of the world? Yes, there is a special combination that seems to be perfect for this, which is love plus the combination of thanks and appreciation reflected in the English word gratitude. Just one of these is not enough. Love needs to be based in gratitude. The gratitude needs to be based in love. These two words together create the most important vibration, and it is even more important that we understand the value of these words. For example, we know the water is described as H2O, and blah, 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 blah. And he goes on, but isn't that freaking amazing? You know, this guy is finding that the thing that changes the molecules of water the most is love in combination of gratitude, which is exactly what is going on with the sacrament and should be going on every time you eat a meal, period, is a love and gratitude combination before you eat it. Blessing this food obviously is changing the molecular structure of the thing. So, and you know, it's saying that's the reason. Well, I think when he was referring to, when he was saying, you know, for this reason many of you are weak and sickly among you, is basically saying that they're not doing the sacrament right, which is, you know, pretty simple, apparently. I mean, I think when you do break the bread and do that just as a remembrance of him, just that he really did exist and really got, you know, really tore up physically for us, you know, and just to remember him, just as like, I remember you, you know, and then as you're eating it, you know, It's a thankful thing. And same thing with grape juice or wine or whatever you choose to do that and remember and think of what it actually means, what this new covenant really means, and to be thankful for it. It could be saving your life. I mean, it's like I said, it's probably so important to our health, and it might be one of those things that God's rules is something that are something that we usually don't understand. But I don't think that we should confuse that with that the answers aren't out there. I think as we get closer to understanding what this universe is really like and what all 10 dimensions really are, if we ever get to that point, you know, maybe after we die, then we're like, oh man, this makes so much sense. How could we be missing it? But it's like a two-dimensional figures. If you reached your three-dimensional hand in there to go, to mess with them, they're not going to perceive it except as a line. It's just as we are living in a ten-dimensional world, we're just, or you know, somewhere thereabouts. None of it's going to make sense, and that's how we were all so easily swindled by these watchers, you know, who just came down here and told us about something we just were unable to perceive, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't physically work. And, you know, so in that sense, all this technology is not exactly something they had to work too hard to give us. But it is interesting how this whole idea of sacrifice is so commonplace in all the ancient pagan religions. No matter what they are, it all comes down to sacrifice. And I think as a general rule, we, you know, a lot of the scholars of today think that the sacrifice is just something that stupid old people used to do. I don't know where they figured they got this idea of sacrifice. They just figured that that's what, you know, stupid savages did to show their appreciation for the sun or whatever they were worshiping. You know, it doesn't add up that everybody all across the whole world would have chosen the sacrifice of animals or people as a way of atoning or worshiping their god of choice. It doesn't make sense that they would do that, have decided that same thing. You know, I'm getting off the subject here, but it goes back to Babel and the separation of Babel, and that we all were once one thing. And that these watchers are, or you know, these sons of God, the Nephilim, which are two different entities and need to be separated properly. But you know, it just doesn't seem how academically you can make that jump unless you do the aliens seeded man thing, because then they could easily say, well, they were all aliens, and whoever this alien race was all wanted the same thing, which was sacrifice. So that's the connection that they're going to make. They have to make the connection of there was once a group of people that were all over the world, were uninhibited by travel methods of the day, that had some new form of travel method in order to communicate the same agenda and the same geometric building processes and revering the same things all over the world. And they'll do that by saying, well, they were aliens, of course. And you can do the exact same thing and a lot more thoroughly with a lot better answers with this idea of Babel was a separation of every language and thought and divided amongst the nations and given their own, given into their own worships. Like, you want to worship these guys, there you go. And he spread everybody out with their own Nephilim, as it were, that was, for a time, ruling over their particular group of people in exchange for sacrificial worship, which is something that we don't understand. And I bet you it's something that these sons of God really got something out of. You know, in the same way, in going back to what we were talking about with the molecular changing of food and stuff, the only thing, even in this new world, after the New Testament, where everything is pure and everything is legal to be eaten, except for anything that has been sacrificed to another god. And he said, you can eat anything else, you know, don't, you know, browbeat anybody, but unless it's been sacrificed to another god. Now, that may change the molecular structure of it, too. I mean, I bet if this guy did some research into that, you might find some really interesting clusters, as it were. But you know, anyway. And so to think that we were just all savages and that's the way we chose to revere our gods of the day, whatever they were, is just ludicrous, or at least it's unsubstantiated in any kind of factual, scholarly basis that I've seen. Man, I really jumped off the tangent there, but I had that on my notes, too, so I think it just kind of happened. I'll put all this stuff on the show notes section that we were talking about earlier at nowheretorun.podomatic.com. nowheretorun.podomatic.com, like podcast, as in. And then also you can email me at chris@conspiracyclothes.com. chris@conspiracyclothes.com, and I will get back to you as soon as I can. I got my laptop now, so I'm just like super connected to the world. As long as there is a Wi-Fi hotspot, I actually have been looking into, you know, they get these different systems where you can get on the internet anywhere and all this stuff. But I'm hoping to find like some really cool thing where that's not directly plugged into the Sprints and Verizon wirelesses of the day. Because I mean, I really am very skeptical of those agencies. So I'd really hope to, like, just get some kind of cool satellite link-up that's, like, independent of it, you know, whatever, but that's probably a long ways off. If anybody knows anything about that, let me know. That would be good. I don't have any money, so that's probably not going to happen. All right, one thing I wanted to talk about was this debunking of this new movie, Zeitgeist. It is a truth movie, quote-unquote, that has been promoted all over the internet. It's... the makers of this movie have been just shoving it down everybody's throats, and it has been picked up like it's a new religion. It's nothing new. These ideas have been around for a long time, but being in a nice, slick movie, all these people that would never have heard this because they never would have read a book, or it wouldn't have been on the, you know, whatever Discovery Channel, it just never caught on. But now it is catching on. It's basically using the same ideas that Christianity is based off pagan religions and showing all these similarities between Horus and Vrishna and Krishna, or didn't use Vrishna, but Krishna and Zoroaster and Mithras and all these things. Now, I was just appalled at this movie calling itself a truth movie. If you want to take it fact by fact, they are dead provably wrong in like over 50, close to 100 different individual errors. And most of them have to do with this Jesus similarities bit. It is so laughably wrong, and I can't, and it's like the Da Vinci Code, you know, you want to go around and tell everybody how stupid that is and how it was total fiction, but the damage is already done. It had been such a big movie, and most people don't care or will never look into it and still go around believing the Da Vinci Code. And even the best of the people that want to believe the Da Vinci Code so desperately, that have a brain and don't drool on themselves, know that you can't believe the Da Vinci Code, because even the person that brought up the whole Merovingian thing admitted it was all BS. Not to mention the plethora of information there that you can know that's ridiculous. But the same thing with this movie. It doesn't matter that these things never happened. This movie says they did, and says so authoritatively that why would you question that? I mean, here's Jordan Maxwell saying it. I mean, please. They say stuff about that just never happened. And my point was, I don't know if they put this on there, because I had talked with them on another thing before and said, you know, to talk about putting the references on it. And here, that now they have the references to where they got this information. They put their movie, they put it on their website. And if you look at the references they're using, they don't use one single ancient text document. And that is to say that they're saying all these similarities exist, but they're not citing anywhere that it says it. They're just citing recent books by Jordan Maxwell and Tim Leadham and all these people that have been like wickedly debunked. And you look at what they're saying and where these people got their information, it's debunked on the order of like it never happened, and it's not even close to provable. Make it quite simply, they're lying their asses off, and people are buying it. So anyway, I wrote this debunking of it, and I've been trying to spread it around the internet. And if you want to help me, you can go to the show notes. I'll list a few of the places I did it. And what I wrote about it was something, you know, I really, really wanted people to know, because they're just falling for this lie, like this religion, and they're defending it like it's their religion, and it's going to be a big deal. It's going to be bigger than even I thought at first. I mean, I was telling my girlfriend, like, this is, you know, big. I know it just seems like a movie, but there's something weird about it. And you know, so anyway, I tried to contact this guy to get, he was one of the guys who runs this website, Tectonics, which is one of the sites that I quote in this debunking. It's an apologetics site. It's really good for a lot of different things, apologetics-wise, you know, that you may have heard. He's pretty much covered it. So I wrote him and told him about the movie and everything, and somebody had just recently told him about it, too, and he just laughed it off, saying how ridiculous it was, and that he'd already debunked all the stuff, and he wasn't going to write anything about it. But he was just kind of mean about other stuff, too. But but I asked him to be on the show. And then I started reading through his website. And although he was really, really right on about a lot of stuff, he was a big Sean Hannity fan, you know, really believed the official line about all that stuff, and was real anti, you know, he was really a disciple of Sean Hannity. So, I mean, you know, he's never going to believe any of this stuff because he's been, you know, and I'm Mr. Conspiracy Theory, so that's not going to go well. I even wrote him back before he wrote me back. He's like, I was reading through your website. It doesn't look like you're going to want. But the main thing was, without going too much into it, his belief that we are not in the last days, and my very much belief that we are in the last days, were going to be a conflict. And it wouldn't normally be a conflict. I obviously could interview anybody about anything, but I think with him, it was a conflict, and combined with the conspiracy theory thing. And he was a very prideful individual about this because I guess he's spent a lot of time debunking some very scholarly, you know, nonsense, which is not really that virtuous. You know, it's just a faith that God was right, so let's go find the evidence. I mean, it's not like you have to be all that smart. God was the smart one. All you're doing is digging up the info. But when it came to the particular view that everybody has, a little bit varying thing about the rapture and the tribulation and all these things that we're not going to understand fully until it happens. I mean, I know that I'm wrong about some stuff, but at least I'm willing to admit that you know, it's not going to happen exactly like I think it happened. I guarantee that. But I think there's a framework that all the body of Christ know, you know, one way or the other. And, you know, if they have something terribly different than all these other good people that are led by the Holy Spirit, then there's a good possibility that the Holy Spirit didn't have anything to do with it. But, you know, I could be wrong about that, too. My point is, he didn't do the show because of that. And it was a shame. And my thing that I wanted him to do anyway was to write up on Zeitgeist, this movie, because I knew he would just infuriate him and that he would just write this scathing review and I could post it around. But obviously he wasn't wanting to do anything with me, so I wrote it myself and posted it around. I'll put that on the show notes of the places I posted it. Maybe you could help me because some of the boards that I posted on get some, you know, anti-Christian sentiment there. But it's all fun and games. It's needs to be done. I mean, somebody has to debunk this stuff because, I mean, we're at a place where people believe this stuff very wholeheartedly, even though they don't have any proof, and it just kills me. This is like the Patriot Truth movement. We get so angry with these little factual inaccuracies in these stupid, you know, movies, and if there's a factual inaccuracy, we just all freak out, unless it's about, you know, Jesus, in which they're all totally wrong. But, oh, that's okay. You know, that's fine, because that's a means to the end. We all know that Christianity's wrong, so if we have to lie to get there, then, you know, that's just, you know, it's a part of the truth movement. It's ridiculous, and we need to stop it. So anyway, there's a little rant. All right, let's take a quick break, and we will play some music and so on, and then I'll be right back with some more information for you.
Gonna drown. Sometimes all I can didn't know when to give up the fight. Some things you want will just never be right. It's never rain like it has tonight before. Now I don't wanna beg you, baby, for something maybe you could never give.
Griffin, and she's an incredible singer and songwriter and one of my favorite artists. So that's Patty Griffin now for her album A Thousand Kisses. Really, really good album too. Okay, what we're going to talk about here is intelligent design and try to start, I'm going to maybe do a few things on this for the next few weeks just to kind of get everybody on the same page and see how ridiculous this is and how important of an aspect this is to the coming New World Order, and to start to see them moving in on this and eliminating the competition. Evolutionary theory, here is something that kind of sparked a little bit of this and made me realize how important this is to start to get everybody educated on it if they haven't been already. The European Union is now, as of, let's see, this is June 24th, 2007, a European human rights body fights creationism. Europe's main human rights body will vote on a proposal next week to defend the teaching of evolution and to keep creationists and intelligent design out of science class in state schools in its 47 member countries. The unusual move shows a U.S. trend for religiously based attacks on the theory of evolution is also worrying European politicians, who now see such arguments put forward in their countries by Christian and Islamic groups. Okay, they're trying to eliminate the competition. Like, as long as we can have nobody talk about the other one, that nasty business of intelligent design, then you know, they've eliminated the competition for this theory that's just that. It's theory and wickedly unsubstantiated. I mean, has holes all over the place. And they try to plug the same thing, like, well, random mutation sifted by natural selection to explain a mutation of a species within its species is somehow related to like planetary evolution, and even like it even goes back to like moving single-celled organisms to multi-celled organisms, which is a totally different scientific animal, but somehow we're applying Darwinism to it. And it's scary, scary, scary stuff, because, you know, we have this idea, intelligent design is not like an apology or anything. Intelligent design is something that has to be looked at. It's a very basic part of science. I mean, if you dug up arrowhead, then you have the scientific capacity to determine that there was an intelligence behind the arrowhead, that the probability of that arrowhead forming in that way or you know, is very unlikely, or the probability of finding a map or a watch or something like that, you have the scientific ability to determine that there was probably an intelligence beyond that. And, you know, I just don't see how they have done this, but they have eliminated it from the scientific probability, and that's the main problem I have with it. And they have eliminated the choice of there being any kind of intelligent design on the basis of Huxley's grandfather, who was behind this whole theory for the most part, or at least promulgation of it, and getting it in as the accepted academic thing to believe is a guy who, you know, the grandfather of a UNESCO head and the guy who brought us A Brave New World. So, I mean, the tie and look into his history, I think we've covered a little bit here on the show, but I mean, this is a globalist situation, and I can't believe that people that know about the New World Order don't see the ties between this and see the European Union shutting down an idea that it could be an intelligent design situation. I mean, the stuff that we are now figuring out about the DNA molecule, dial, whatever you call that thing, is becoming obvious mostly and was from the beginning to computer programmers. I mean, it's a computer code. And the thing is that every cell has a copy of the exact same DNA. And so the question is, so if this DNA is in every cell, but it's not telling the cell what to do, I mean, just because it has a piece of DNA and one cell is a skin cell and one cell is a heart cell, I mean, there's no difference. There has to be some extra thing telling you what to do. And that's why you got scientists killing themselves with theoretical physics quantum physics. It doesn't make any sense, but it is undeniably true. It's not, I mean, literally, scientists kill themselves over this because it doesn't make any sense under their thing. Non-local awareness and the ability for two, you know, photons to react to one another, you know, under no grounds or no understanding of it. It just doesn't make any sense. There has to be something more than we don't even close to understand here. My point is, and what I've been beating around the bush is, that some guys got around a room in Huxley's day, and were like, and to this day, the ones that have infiltrated these universities and whatnot, and it's not the people that go to college's fault. I mean, they spend a lot of money to have this shoved down their throat, so they have a pride built up with it. It's like, I spent a lot of money. I know what I'm talking about, okay? This happened. I can sing this song sheet, and I spent a lot of money, so don't tell me any different. And, you know, it's the same thing like the Zeitgeist movie that we were talking about. Just because somebody with a PhD tells you it's true doesn't mean that you shouldn't look for yourself to see if it's true, especially if you have a question about it, if something doesn't add up, you know, because there are plenty of things that just don't add up with this. I mean, the irreducible complexity idea of, you can, even Darwin himself said, I mean, if the irreducible complexity idea is wrong, if there are machines that are greater, and at this time, you know, his whole thing depended on the single cell, the simple cell, and it turns out there's no such animal. Even the most basic cells are amazing factories that one piece of the puzzle can't be removed without taking it's called irreducible complexity. One piece can't be taken away because then the whole cell will break down. So at some point, that cell just had to pop into existence in full form. You can't just, like, have one piece of it, one mechanism show up at a time. But here we are. What I'm saying is that these people got in a room and they're like, well, we all as good scientists believe there's no God, right? We're all in complete agreement like that. Oh, yes, of course, no. Well, let's find out how this happened, but let's not look into it. You know, let's not use that. Let's not look at the idea that there could have been an intelligence. It's the one rule when trying to figure out how this happened. Which is, like, really unscientific, you know, is that determining a outcome that you already believe and then back engineering it to find out how it relates to the outcome that you've already decided is the opposite of science, you know. This, you're supposed to do, you know, use the scientific method to come to a probable outcome based on the evidence, not decide something based on dogma and then figure out and think of experiments that would help point to your view and then shove that down everybody's throats.
It's like, oh, yeah, it sounds like a wonderful idea, but it talks like...
You got all this stuff that's pointing to it. It doesn't have to be God. It doesn't have to be whatever. You can back off of that if you want, but we're seeing all this information that, like, an anthropologist is looking at this stuff saying, this is kind of impossible if this is just, if there's no direction, and that's the whole point of this, that every mutation had to have no purpose, absolutely accidental. And on, you can take that in a micro way and show that it doesn't work like in the actual chimpanzees to man in Africa after this division was created by this cataclysm that produced a separation and isolation. So one was able to develop on the human beings as we now know it developed on the plains of Africa, while the chimpanzees remained chimpanzees on the west side of this rift that was created, even though we now know that there was contamination, which means it couldn't have happened, and also that there wasn't enough time. That's where the idea of it's so mathematically improbable, it's functionally impossible, came to be. There's just not enough time to, at the most gimmies you can give somebody, there's not enough time to have enough random mutations to produce that many changes. And so the mathematicians are coming back with the numbers that show that this is impossible. And the evolution scientists are telling them to go back and try it again because they know it happened. They know that it happened because it can't happen any other way. You know, they got to have it. And so the mathematicians keep coming back and saying, sorry, it doesn't work. You know, got to find something else. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that's going on. But you know, it's not a debate that you're going to hear about in your school because they are working to make sure you don't hear about it, to make sure you don't understand that DNA is junk DNA is a ridiculous concept. It's such a prideful notion to say that because we don't know what 90% of the DNA is doing, it must have no use and therefore be a product of evolution, some other, you know, useless thing, which we've now shown it has functionality, like tremendous functionality, and we have no clue. Just because we don't know what it does, I mean, we only recently mapped the genome, and now we're deciding that because we don't know everything, it's somehow wrong. I mean, this is far more complex than we're giving anything credit for. And to say, to just assume things at this point without putting it through a scientific method is ridiculous. Okay, man, I guess I spent a little more time ranting about that than I intended to. I intended to play a clip, but I am going to do that. Just like we said, I'm going to play a debate here that really illustrates some of these points, and the guy just wails on him. I didn't choose this because my guy won. It's the only debate that I've downloaded ever. I have some other stuff, some speakers on it and stuff, but this is a really good debate, and I want you to notice that the best arguments are being put forth here. I mean, it's not about one guy sucks and one guy doesn't. I mean, the guy sucks because the other guy just has logic and is able to use logic against a guy who must not use it. And I want you to really see how ridiculous this is from somebody that is a much better scientist than I am. And I am not a scientist, by the way. I went to film school. So anyway, let's do this. I guess we're running out of time on the Revere Radio end. So those of you on iTunes and that get the show through various podcasters, just hang on. It's going to be played in its entirety. And for those of you on Revere Radio, I'm just going to play this little bit. If you like what you hear, you can always download the entire show. You can go to nowheretorun.podomatic.com and you can see the show notes and you can download the full length thing there. Also, I want to let everybody know a few things that I think is a really good idea is New Testament audio. If you don't read the Bible as much as you should or whatever, go find a place on the internet that has the New Testament for free, or the Old Testament, or whatever. I know that there's one, a really good produced version of the New Testament. I'll try to link you to it on the show notes. And it's just an amazing way to multitask and listen to that at the same time. God has a way of like putting, making you accidentally listen to the part that you really needed. And, you know, it's great because you can be driving a car or doing whatever and getting this information too. The only difference is, well, a bad thing is that the one I'm talking about came in like one full clip. It's like 100 megabytes, but I personally broke it down into hour segments so it was easily manageable, so I could just skip to different ones. But I highly recommend either way you do it. If you just go looking for yourself, if you get iPods and MP3 players and that type of thing, go look for that. It's really, really helpful. Remember to email me, chris@conspiracyclothes.com. Let me know where I'm wrong, what I did wrong, right. Tell me, send me your hate mail and all that good stuff. And also remember to pray for Ron Paul, pray for God's will to be done, and to pray for the people that might be able to come out and speak out against 9/11 and things. Pray for them to have courage. All right, guys, I'm going to start playing this clip. Revere Radio, it'll probably end in about 5 minutes with the rest of you guys. It'll be there in its entirety. All right, take it easy, guys. We are in the last days. We should start acting like it. Power to the people. All glory to God. Take it easy.
To tell me and all of us, if you were charged with that, if you had a paragraph or two to explain intelligent design to newspaper readers, not to scientific readers or anybody else, how would you do it?
David, thank you. And thanks to Peter for joining us and for all of you for coming. I'll give you our straight-up definition, and then maybe there's time I'll tell you why we might have objected a bit as to the way you portrayed us.
Sure.
I do appreciate the question so directly. The theory of intelligent design holds that there are certain features of the universe and of living systems that are best explained by an intelligent cause rather than an undirected natural process. And so what do we mean by that? And that's our short synopsis.
We've got one paragraph
okay.
Now. What was the second one?
That was only a sentence. Okay. Well, the kind of features we're talking about are things that have been discovered in science over the last half century. The fine-tuning of the laws of physics and chemistry in the area of physics. The exquisite nanotechnology that has been discovered inside cells, the miniature machines, the engines, the sliding clamps, the protein copy machines, and little rotary engines. If you got our little handout as you walked in, you can see some of the kinds of things that interest us in that regard. And then thirdly, the most interesting thing to me personally is the discovery of the reams and reams of digital code that's stored inside DNA and transmitted in RNA. And these are features that we think are best explained by an intelligent cause rather than a purely undirected process. Now, in saying that, it's important to understand what we're not saying. We're not necessarily challenging the idea of evolution per se, at least as defined as change over time or even common ancestry. But we are challenging the specifically Darwinian idea that life is the result of a purely undirected process that mimics the powers of a designing intelligence. About a year ago, Richard Dawkins was here from Oxford University. Dawkins is famous for saying that biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. We take the opposite view. We think that things really were designed. They don't just appear to be designed. And we think that the scientific evidence supports that conclusion.
My editor's here, and if I could write paragraphs that long, I think we could all agree I could get it down. And this is the problem. Peter, let me ask you, if you can put aside just for this exercise your feelings about this, the debate and everything else, if you had to explain to your students what it is that Steve promotes, what it is that he supports, how would you describe this?
Dogma. Where were you all on my last book tour? Hopefully I'm seeing some of you, some of my Biology 354 people next Monday. I'm the other guy after Ray. I'm the second half of the Ray and Peter duo. And if you're here, thank you. Let me know your name. I like Steve a lot, and I really worry about what intelligent design is doing to our country, it's doing to our kids. What worries me most is this whole idea that we should teach the controversy. It sounds so overtly reasonable. But first off, you have to realize that anything that George Bush is pushing,
I mean, now wait a minute, Peter, hold on a sec. Peter, a couple of minutes ago, though, you were concerned about this becoming a political issue, and let's just let the record show you're the first one to bring up George Bush. Let me bring you back just a little bit to this.
Okay, this is my microphone. This is a political issue.
It is, so, and that's why I'm here, clearly. But
let's briefly look at the aspect of letting our kids have a science class where we give equal time to evolution and intelligent design. Patrick, where are you?
I'm going to stop you, though, for a second. Oh. I want you to try to, and it's not a debate, but let's try to answer that question. Is there a way that you can just try to explain this concept, this theory?
It's not a theory. That's the thing. It's not science. It's not a theory, so I can't explain it as a theory. I can explain it as a political dogma.
Okay. Then, Steve, let me go back to you for a second. You said if given the time, you would critique how I described it. And in the story today, which was for a newspaper story kind of long, it's done in little bits and pieces, frankly. We don't put it all in one. But in general, intelligent design argues that life is so biologically complex, there must be some kind of supernatural designer involved. The concept, however, leaves the designer unnamed. What's wrong with that piece?
I feel your pain, first of all, because I've written op-eds, and I know how hard it is to squeeze things in a few words. But here's why we quibble with your definition. When we argue for design, we're not arguing based on a negative assessment of the powers of various naturalistic mechanisms, natural selection, for example. It's not just a critique of natural selection. This is so complex, natural selection couldn't produce it, therefore it was designed. That's not our argument. We do critique the relevant naturalistic hypotheses as to their explanatory power with respect to, for example, these exquisite machines or circuits in cells, or I think even more importantly, the digital code in cells. But we're also making a positive case for design based upon our knowledge, not our ignorance, but our knowledge of the cause and effect structure of the world. It is part of our knowledge that there is a cause that is sufficient to produce digital code. We know that that cause is intelligence. From our own experience, Bill Gates, for example, has said that DNA is like a software program, only much more complex than any that's ever been written. Now, we know from experience that when you build things that function like software code, inevitably there's a mind or an intelligence involved. When I was doing my doctoral work in Cambridge, I was very much interested in whether or not this new argument from design could be made into a rigorous scientific argument. Peter and I both have a background in historical sciences and in paleontology, geology. And I went back to the source, to Darwin and to his mentor, Lyell. And the key methodological maxim that they enjoined upon historical scientists was a very much common sense idea, which is that if you're trying to explain the past, you shouldn't invent exotic causes of the sort we've never seen in operation, but rather you should invoke causes that are known to produce the effect in question. And Lyell's way of framing that was to say we should be looking for presently acting causes. Well, I asked the question, what's the presently acting cause of digital code? We know of only one, that's intelligence. So we're not arguing from our ignorance of cause and effect process, but rather our knowledge of it.
Okay. Well, Peter, how do you, if we can try to stick to that, I'm obviously handicapped because I'm not an academic. I'm not a biologist, a paleontologist. You are. So if you can respond to that on my behalf, how would you? What is the scientific argument against that?
We really need to, first of all, I think a nice thing to do right to begin here is instead of asking what is life, what is science? Science is not an assemblage of facts, truth, not capital T, truth. Scientists test things. And so a way that I would approach and have approached this idea about intelligent design is ask the question, which you can also ask of evolutionary biology, what set of data that you could find would totally convince you you're absolutely wrong? And I could pose this to Stephen. I know what I would do. If I could go out and I would find a dinosaur fossil with a human head in the jaws of a T-Rex, I guarantee I would not be accepting evolutionary biology in the Skirton guys. because we would know that is an absolutely falsifiable set of findings that makes what we understand, what we teach, and the set of many, many, many hypotheses and theories that make up evolutionary biology, it's not just one. If I were to find that, or if I were to go back to the Devonian or the Ordovician and find a monkey sitting among those Ordovician brachiopods, we have made a big mistake. Now, I ask you that. What set of findings would make convince you that ID as you understand it has been falsified?
That's a good question. I'd say one thing as a preamble. If we found that, we'd both end up being young Earth creationists, the thing about the, you know. I'm not. I hold to the
older. You're an older Earth creationist.
Well, whatever you want to call it.
Thank you.
First of all, I think the theory of intelligent design is eminently testable.
It's not a theory, though.
I think it is. I think it's testable by in the same way that Darwin's theory of evolution was testable, in the same way that Darwin set out to test his theory, which was against a suite of different evidences. He listed these different classes of facts that supported his argument for example, universal common descent. I don't think theories are tested by one silver bullet experiment. I think it's usually a weighing of the preponderance of evidence. I wouldn't accept the way you framed your question, but I think there are a number of key tests of intelligent design. All historical theories are tested in two ways. The first is in their ability to explain already known facts. This is critical in the Darwinian synthesis. It's not that because we are unable to replicate the past under controlled laboratory experiments, historical scientists are often put in the position of having to explain already known facts, and the way you test a theory is by comparing its explanatory power against its nearest competitor. Some of the key things that I put on the table at the beginning of the discussion, the presence of this nanotechnology in cells, the presence of information, I think intelligent design has already been tested because it is capable.
What is that test?
The test is what theory best explains the information embedded in DNA, where best is determined by what we know about the cause and effect structure of the world. And you and I both have a fascination with these experiments, the RNA world experiments. And what we find there is that the hottest theory of the origin of life, that is the naturalistic alternative to intelligent design, is relying heavily on so-called ribozyme engineering, the attempt to get RNA molecules to perform certain
But Stephen, you haven't answered my question. What, is that the test you're going to do? Is it ribozyme?
The key test is show me a process that generates information and large amounts of specified information without the guidance of an intelligent agent. This ribozyme engineering work that I know you're so interested in, as am I, is guided by intelligence. Such benefits, such improvements in the efficiency of replication, for example, that are achieved, and so far they're fairly minimal, are achieved because an intelligent agent is guiding that. I say those experiments are actually simulating the power of intelligence, and everything we know is that only intelligence produces information. So we test our theories against our knowledge of the cause and effect structure
right.
of the world.
I want to let Peter get, but let me add one follow-up to you. Do you believe that intelligent design has faced as rigorous a scientific test as Darwinian evolution? I mean, are they equal in terms of being put to the test?
I think, first of all, there are many things that Darwinian evolution can explain. Okay. But there are some very key things that Darwinian evolution, and in particular, chemical evolutionary theory of the origin of the first life, cannot and has not explained. And I used to ask my students, if you want to give your computer a new functionality, what do you have to give it? And the answer is, you have to give it new lines of code. The same thing is true in life. And so the fact that these evolutionary theories have not been able to explain the origin of the first information is not a minor anomaly. This is a fundamental theory, a theoretical problem. It's a fundamental lacuna. Any theory that can't account for the origin of information, when we now understand that information runs the show in biology, is a theory that has a serious theoretical gap.
Okay, equal time. Equal
yeah,
time.
Please.
He's just so smooth, though. I can sit
Sorry,
back and
I'll,
listen
I'll slow
to
down.
One of the beautiful things about science is it's predictive. And the biological theories that we call evolution, there are so many, predict many things. And they also produce things. Now, one of the great predictive aspects of this body of knowledge that we call evolutionary theory is that it is our first line of defense against something that I think affects every one of us, infectious disease. We know that viruses mutate. We know that bacteria evolve. We have to stay one step ahead of that. And I would suggest that all who really, if you really believe in intelligent design, you're not allowed to use antibiotics.
That's not true.
It's forever taken away from you. You're not allowed to have this stuff. So my point here, Steve, is what is the predictive power that ID can do? What will it predict and what will it produce? Because what evolutionary theory has done has ended up an enormous number of predictions that have had huge power and have actually had material production. What can ID do along those lines?
That's a great question. Let me give a couple examples. For a few of you may have grabbed our handout on the way in. You may know that there's an ongoing debate about the origin of the molecular machines in the cell, the bacterial flagellar motor, this little rotary engine that Michael Behe has made famous in his book Darwin's Black Box. He's been critiqued by Ken Miller, a biologist at Brown University. Behe's at Lehigh. It looks for all the world like a scientific debate. Miller has noted that there's a little syringe-like pump that has many of the same protein parts that make up a bacterial flagellar motor. Miller argues that that syringe is an ancestral form of the flagellar motor. Behe argues that it's a degenerative product of the genetic information that made the motor as a whole. Now, that's a chicken or egg question. Which came first? And that's a very testable question. Which of those two systems is older? Which is younger? And papers are beginning to come in on this, one by Milton Sayer recently, actually favoring Behe's position, although somewhat tentatively. My colleague Scott Minnick at the University of Idaho, a microbiologist, is doing a number of experiments to test this very thing. We think there's very strong evidence that the flagellar motor is ancestral, the motor as a whole and the genes that made it are ancestral, and that the type 3 secretory system, as it's called, is a byproduct of that and derivative of that. For one thing, the genes for building the type 3 secretory system occur on little plasmids that are derivative from other genomes. There's several cases of this, but it's all the same conclusion. So very simple. There's an argument. There's a critical test. Which is younger? Which is older? There's a number of ways to test that, phylogenetic studies and so forth. Michael Behe's ID theory is very testable.
Okay, let's go back and let me ask the question again. I see why he's got such a pretty face. It's like Muhammad Ali. He dodges and weaves. This is great. Tell me what are the predictive powers of ID? What can it give us? If it's a scientific theory, there will be predictions that accrue. What are they going to be?
Well, I just made one, first of all.
Secondly,
I'll give a couple others. Okay.
Okay.
When we talked last on, was it Dory, right? Dory Monson?
Dory Monson.
I talked about the whole issue of junk DNA. Okay. There are two very important papers have come out in the last year saying that neo-Darwinism has been heuristically unfruitful with respect to the whole question of these non-coding regions of the genome.
Heuristically unfruitful.
It's exactly what you're asking about.
Okay.
What, you know, has it made good predictions that have led us to new discoveries, or has it led us down a blind alley? Conclusion, James Shapiro, Richard von Sternberg, it's led us down a blind alley. It says, neo-Darwinism says, hey, if observes that there's big sections of the genome that don't code for proteins, because we assume that genetic information is produced by a trial and error process, then we would assume that there'd be a lot of so-called junk DNA. That was the first conclusion Crick drew in 1980 about it. Well, it's turning out that there's lots of hidden functions in that non-coding region, which is exactly something that we would predict from a design theoretic point of view, because we don't think information was produced by a higgledy-piggledy trial and error process.
But couldn't that as easily just be the fact that science is now getting better and better in understanding the huge complexity of DNA? Science is not truth. We're adding information all the time, and we're constantly changing ideas and hypotheses.
I agree with this idea
of junk DNA, it was called junk DNA because a generation ago, the people looking at this had a very poor understanding of how things work at that particular level, and there's less and less junk in that DNA now.
But
this is not
the theoretical framework of Darwinism did lead us down to a blind alley. But let me give you another example.
What is
my
Darwinism?
Let me give you another example rather than defined terms.
I don't know what Darwinism is, though.
It's the synthetic theory of, yeah.
Can you define Darwinism?
We should. I want to talk about it, but let
well,
him
I want to answer his main,
answer.
His main
finish,
question
finish
about predictive
answer, but then
capacity.
Let's talk about that. Go ahead.
A couple years ago, Bruce Alberts had an article in Cell saying that to be effective cell biologists in the age of molecular machines, we need to be training our students as design engineers. And my colleague Jonathan Wells has taken that up with some seriousness, and he says he's interested in a particular form of cancer. He has a hypothesis about what has caused it, and he is applying principles of design engineering to understand the functioning of centrioles. He hypothesizes that they are functioning on the same principles of turbines. They not only look like turbines, but they actually are turbines. He's had a Boeing engineer help him work up some of the mathematical calculations, and he's now able to explain some of the effects that may be responsible for a particular form of cancer. So he's using an explicitly designed theoretic framework to guide his research in hopes that we discover some new things that
but
we wouldn't have otherwise.
You've lost me. How does that relate to intelligent design?
He's not just saying, as a Darwinian would do, things look designed but they're not really designed. He says, no, they really are designed, so I'm going to apply principles of mechanical engineering to try to guide my search for other unknown structures in the cell. He's using design as a positive guide to discovery.
Peter, can I ask you a question?
I didn't think it was that hard to understand. I don't know.
I missed it.
Draw a distinction between evolution, Darwinian evolution, and now we also heard the phrase neo-Darwinism. Do you see those distinctions? Do those mean something to you?
Well, there's a lot of ways to, I guess, put things in boxes. What we call evolutionary biology is composed of a huge number now of interesting testable hypotheses. And what is a theory? A theory is simply a hypothesis that has withstood so many different tests that it is rather a next layer up. It's certainly not a truth with a capital T. We have so many aspects of studying what we call evolutionary biology. My particular way of looking at it is examining the fossil record and to explicitly test ideas and hypotheses. One of the really interesting things to me, and in a major sense, one of the things that I do mostly is I study extinction. Now, it seems to me that a major test of ID, if that designer is so damn good, why is it that 99% of all species ever produced are extinct? I mean, that's really crappy design.
Yeah.
Why is it that I'm turning into such old age so fast? I mean, that's crappy design, too. And I'm really pissed at the designer on that little deal. If we try to call something Darwinism, a lot of us object to that because it is really one of the ways that you can do this is stand up this sort of cardboard thing we call Darwinism, and then what the ID people try to do is knock it down. And if it's knocked down, then what's standing? Well, I mean, the ID people will tell you it's ID. But again, science is a very different thing than knocking down cardboard cutouts. I think if you look at any of the web tracking devices of science and you type in keywords and you ask how many articles, comments, references are there to any aspect of evolution, it's in the hundreds of thousands to millions. Now, you do the same thing on intelligent design in the scientific literature, and you're in the hundreds.
This is good, Steve. This is what I was trying to ask you earlier. Do you think that intelligent design has been put to the same test? You have 100 years of research and debate and questions and challenges to one theory, and you have, I don't know how much on the other side, but a decade of real work on
well,
that side? I mean, they can't be equal, can they?
Yeah, certainly this is a new theory. I mean, you know,
it's not a theory.
is that an applause line, really? I mean, that's... certainly it's a new theory, but the reason that we...
He's allowed to call it a theory, and Peter,
we have on our website a list of the peer-reviewed articles and books that have been published. There's some significant work going on here, some of it published with mainstream universities.
Are they in the tens, and, the hundreds?
In the tens. Significant books. When Darwin's theory of evolution was published...
But evolution is in the millions now.
Well, but right. There are also... accumulating anomalies for the theory that have been building up over a century. And you know, there's the same literature that discusses evolution also discusses the significant problems with it. I want to go back to the challenge that was raised. You know, are we erecting a cardboard cutout of Darwinian evolution, or is there a reason we use the term neo-Darwinism? There is. Evolution can mean many different things. I've written an essay called The Meanings of Evolution. I've identified at least six different meanings. Many other people who write in the area would agree. But three key meanings. It can mean change over time. It can mean the common ancestry or the idea of universal common ancestry, Darwin's tree of life picture of the history of life. And it can also mean, it can refer to a mechanism, and specifically the idea that natural selection acting on various forms of mutations is sufficient to produce the form and function that we see around us and the appearance of design. Now, when we use the term neo-Darwinism, we do so because we want to be clear about what we're challenging and what we're not. In challenging, the theory of intelligent design does not challenge the first two meanings of evolution, change over time or the idea of common ancestry, though some of us are skeptical about universal common ancestry. But it does specifically challenge the idea that a purely undirected process, natural selection acting on random variations or other similarly materialistic mechanisms, can account for the for all the form that we see in the biological world. So we're not trying to be erect a stereotype of the theory and knock it down. Just the opposite. We're trying to be clear and precise about what we are critiquing and what we're not.
I saw Peter jump when you said there are people who question the universal ancestry. What goes through your head when you heard that?
Well, I personally, I have my own sense about it. I'm really interested in the origin of life, not just on this planet, but on any planet. And I suspect that we're going to really understand that there are many more kinds of life that can be built. In my recent book plug moment, Life as We Do Not Know It, I really do attempt to think about, gee, if it's not DNA life, what could it be? And if it's not our kind of DNA life, and it turns out there'd be a variety of ways you can make DNA. And there's a fabulous evolutionist at University of Florida, Steve Benner, who invented a DNA that uses a different language. The language of DNA is using a series of bases to spell out, I want to use this amino acid or this amino acid to build a protein. We're all made of proteins. Well, he made a DNA that uses a different language, totally fake DNA. And he uses it to help us survive, those of us afflicted with hepatitis B. And he's a multimillionaire from this. He changed. He was God. He changed the nature of the basic stuff of life using evolutionary principles.
Brilliant design engineering.
It certainly was. And he used it to help kill off a highly undesigned but very bad bug. Thank you.
Can I say something about those bad bugs?
I think they are bad bugs.
They are bad. We agree on that. We agree on a lot. That's funny. I have a colleague, Scott Minnick, who works on pathogenic things, bad stuff. And turns out that this flagellar motor that Mike Behe has made so much of is very important in understanding the origin of pathogenicity and some of the, like the plague and other things. And what Minnick has discovered is that a number of these bad critters, these bad things that are excreted that cause the plague and other killer diseases, are the result of mutational degradation of a clearly aboriginal design, the original genome that builds the bacterial flagellar motor.
So what the hell was your designer thinking when he made the plague?
Well, the point is that the plague was not part of the aboriginal design. You asked a minute ago about extinctions. I mean, everything that we design, the fact that things...
Who's we? Is that the royal we?
We.
Oh, okay.
You and I are kind of pointy heads. Maybe we don't design much at all. We just talk for a living. But the point is that humans design things, and eventually they decay. And so the fact that there are extinctions or the fact that there are mutations that degrade original designs that are good but then cause harm to us is not a problem to design theory. That's something that you would expect.
Is that your answer? You know, Peter asked earlier about, you know, he feels like he's getting old, so he's angry at the designer. How do you, I mean, is that sort of the why do good things happen to bad people argument? What do you say if there is a designer, supreme designer, who figured this out? How do you answer those sorts of questions that Peter raised?
The question is parasitic off of a theological assumption. It means that...
I'm glad you said that. I don't know. Explain.
The question is parasitic off of a theological assumption. it's borrowing something from theology. Namely, the assumption behind the question is, if there is an intelligent designer, then why isn't everything perfect?
Okay. Yeah.
Now, we're looking at this as scientists and saying, you know, there are certain key hallmarks of intelligent activity. One of them is information. One of them is the functional integration of parts that perform a function. Behe calls that irreducible complexity. So we infer to an intelligence. Now, people want to say, well, why didn't the intelligence do it this way, that way, or the other? Well, to answer that question, you get immediately into theology, if you're thinking that the designer is God. If you're thinking that the designer is not God, that it's some kind of intelligence, the identity of which we know not, then those problems don't really arise. Either way, the theologians have answers for those questions. They say, you know, God didn't see fit to make us immortal because we're prideful and we're not ready for that. That's a theological answer. In other words, whether you take a theological perspective on design or whether you just take a generic understanding of design built from analogy to our own experience as designers, we have reasons to expect that you would see evidence of design, but also evidence of decay. So the fact of extinction is, I don't think, a decisive argument against design.
So, Stephen, who is this or what is this designer, in your view?
In my view, the designer is God. Okay, but David's point, I don't know if our guys at Discovery hit you about this or not. But
how do we test for God? Science can not.
I'm not saying we
God.
Can test. For, I'm not saying
but
we can test for God.
Then ID can't be a science because we can test for the process.
You've made a jump in logic. You can test for intelligence.
Hold on. We'll get to questions later. Give us a chance.
I wonder if we could give that heckler a round of applause for making the evening more memorable.
Whatever you say, we're not going to box. We like each other. It ain't going to happen. But if you're here for red meat, I'm sorry. We're vegetarians.
Let me address this in context of what David wrote this morning, okay? The theory of intelligent design holds that an intelligent cause can explain...
It's not a theory.
Can explain certain things. Okay? And the reason that we say that is that there are certain key features based on our cause and effect structure of the world that we know only intelligence can build. One of those is digital code. So when we find digital code in the cell, we think that it is a warranted inference to infer that there was a prior intelligence. Now, we don't claim to be able to know from the scientific evidence the identity of the designer. The scientific methods of design detection that have been developed by people like William Dembski in his book Design Inference with Cambridge Press enable us to infer to an intelligence. We do this all the time, by the way. If you're an archaeologist and you see inscriptions in the Rosetta Stone, you infer that it was a scribe, not wind and erosion. There are criteria that enable us to detect intelligent cause.
Except with the Rosetta Stone, we know who the author was. We know that it was a human carving. Give me 1 second, Peter.
The point is we're not claiming from the scientific evidence to be able to know that the designer is God.
I understand,
okay?
So
Peter's made a jump here in saying that ID is not testable. We're not claiming the thing he says is not testable. We're only claiming that the presence of an intelligence versus an undirected process is detectable and testable with scientific
methods.
Of course I made
a
jump. I believe in punctuated equilibrium. Thank you.
So Peter, what do you make of the Cambrian explosion? Do you hold a polyphyletic or a monophyletic view of the history of life?
You know, I was hoping we'd get to that. And one of the really wonderful things that we do compare is Cambrian explosion. I've been up to the Burgess Shale. And one of the real interesting things about the Burgess Shale is that the damn Canadians control it so tightly. Are there any Canadians here?
A little too late now on that one.
I was a landed immigrant. Richard Nixon was not going to kill me. But I came back. And what I'd like you to know is I've been up to the Burgess Shale. And what happened there is that you have to carry out all your own wastes. So all the scientists who go up there get a tin can with your name on it. So anything that you produce, you bring back down out there with you. Steve Gould was up there, and not only did he have to carry out his own waste, he had to be carried up on a sedan chair and came back again. But it's an amazing place for understanding, I mean, this view of life and this grandeur of life. Now, what's so spectacular is the Burgess Shale was really thought to be the only real window into the past so we could get soft-parted creatures. But a fantastic new place, as you know, Zhangjiang in China, we now have another window 10 million years prior to the Burgess. The same sort of preservation, where not only the fossils, not only their hard parts, but soft parts are preserved. And lo and behold, they're less evolved than the Burgess. It's a two-part snapshot. If you ever want the most fabulous reaffirmation that evolution took place, you just look at the Burgess and look at Zhangjiang. And I think you have a tremendous sense of a tree going back towards its roots. evolution is writ large in almost biblical proportions, excuse me, if you go out and look at the rock record.
I disagree with the assessment. I've also been to the top. We got a big kick out of it. I took my son.
Oh, your cams?
Yeah. Well, the fact that we made it back down and Steve Gould had to be airlifted off. You know, we
did.
A couple of years ago, we sponsored one of the leading Chinese paleontologists in your department to come speak in your department, J.Y. Chen. And I dispute your assessment that you have lesser complexity at the base of the explosion. The Chengjiang fossils are beautifully preserved.
Oh, they are.
And you have trilobites. They've now discovered fishes there.
But what I'm saying, they're less. The lobopods, for instance. Let's go into lobopods. You've got far more complex in the Burgess than your Chengjiang. Evolution has increased diversity. It has increased complexity.
You have some animals that are less complex because they weren't known before.
Okay, trust me on this, Stephen. Trust me on this.
Don't pull rank here. I've written on this, too.
No. You can't go there with this.
Anyway, J.Y. Chen is at your department, and he doesn't accept the tree picture. He says it's upside down. You get the major diversification, major innovation of form right from the base of the Cambrian. And it's not an argument. That's a gesture.
No pantomime.
In case you've not taken logic. Afterwards, he's very skeptical of universal common descent.
Yes, that's one. And, now I can cite 100 who absolutely disagree with him.
He was asked, you're so skeptical about the standard Darwinian doctrine of universal common descent. And he said, well, in my country, he says, you can question Darwin, but you can't question the government. He says, in this country, you can question the government, but you can't question Darwinism.
Well,
all right.
I want to go.
What's Darwinism?
Well, I think we've been through that.
The conjunct of universal common descent and the theory of natural selection and random mutation.
I think we've been through that. Let me go back to God for a second, since some folks at Discovery think I'm obsessed with a question. Here's what's difficult for me to wrap my head around, and I think Peter was getting this. If the designer is unnamed, but nearly all the advocates say that in their religious view, it's God. But that's not a scientific view. I mean, there's very few advocates of intelligent design who name a designer other than God, correct?
There are a few that are religiously agnostic, like Michael Denton, or the Buddhist Jeffrey Schwartz, the neuroscientist at UCLA. Berlinski, who is sympathetic to design but not a proponent, is agnostic religiously. So I think some interesting other examples, not from our camp, but from the evolutionary world of evolutionary biology, would be people like Fred Hoyle, Chandra Wickramasinghe, and even Francis Crick, who speculated that life had been designed and transported here from outer space, the so-called panspermia theory. So there are other options, and that's one of the. We're not trying to be sneaky. I think one of the things we objected to about your article is that it slightly hinted that we were being disingenuous in this.
And
maybe you didn't mean that.
I certainly didn't mean disingenuous.
Some people have said it directly. You guys are being sneaky.
Yeah, and the judge said it.
We were.
The judge said it in Dover.
But we're just trying to. It's the opposite, though, David. We're just trying to be careful about what the science says, what it implies, what it points to.
Am I going to separate you two?
Yeah.
But let me just. I'll give you a chance on this,
Peter. We see evidence
of
an intelligence. But it is a second-order philosophical question as to the nature and identity of that intelligence. When you see gene sequences that function like software code, you can see mind is at work. But there's no signature. It doesn't say made by anyone.
I understand, but you have the majority of the fellows say God is the designer. You have funders who have openly stated religious positions and agendas and promote that. And it really becomes a small little piece of middle ground then to say it's been designed, we're not going to say by who. The people with the money, the people getting the money have an answer to that. It just seems like a shrinking piece to try to maintain the non-named designer, right?
We're interested in evidence and arguments, okay? And we think the evidence strongly supports the reality of a prior designing intelligence. We don't go further in identifying the designer on the basis
that?
Of science.
How do you test that?
In
how
some
do
of the
test
ways that I mentioned previously.
Science cannot test for the supernatural, and that's what you're having. It cannot test for the supernatural. Science just cannot deal with what you want it to go. Therefore, it is not science.
If your argument was true, Peter, then we would not be able to test the conclusion that the Rosetta Stone had been made by an intelligent agent rather than a wind and erosion.
Oh, that's crap.
That again was not an argument. The point is, we test our inferences about the past against our knowledge of the cause and effect structure of the world. We know from experience that intelligence produces information. When we find information on the Rosetta Stone, we therefore infer that there was an intelligent cause at work. That is testable against the backdrop of our knowledge of cause and effect experience.
I see Joe Felsenstein in the audience, probably one of the world's greatest evolutionists, and I see him, well, I should see his expressions. I would love that if Joe could come up here, I guess he can't, and talk to us about your comment about intelligence in this digital code business. From my own point of view, you're going on. Joe!
No, that's okay. The next one.
It seems to me that digital code is one of the things that I study. I study the appearance and the disappearance of things. So when I look at the fossil record, it really is a digital yes, no. It's around for a while, then it goes extinct. And so I'm looking at terminations, presence, absence. That's a whole digital code. It's got nothing to do with intelligence. And yet here is this beautiful pattern. Where it is coming from is extinction or not extinction based on adaptations of organisms. AID has nothing to do with this. This is simply natural selection and extinction, and sometimes meteors from space. And unless your designer is throwing the damn meteors, then how do you account for this?
I'm talking about the digital code in DNA. You're confusing that with
analytical pattern. You are saying there's no biological pattern of digital code that is not produced by an intelligence. I just gave you one.
That's not functional information. That's your
description. It's real information.
That's your description of the pattern in the fossil record.
And we have, what's wrong with my description?
I'm sure it's accurate, Peter. That's not the problem.
We have 10 minutes left.
Let's talk about teaching
the controversy, Peter. Thank
Good.
You.
Okay.
Let me start with you. Is there a controversy over Darwinian evolution?
There are so many controversies within evolutionary biology. I mean, where do I start? We have, everywhere we look are controversies, but there are controversies in every science. There are thousands of controversies in physics or in chemistry or in any field of biology. Why do we single out evolutionary biology? The fact that we have controversies, just like Cobb County, Georgia, we put a little sticker on it, let's single out evolution. The fact that we have controversies somehow makes us less legitimate as a science. That's what science is. It is nothing but controversies. Why do we single out? So I have a 9-year-old. Patrick Ward, are you here? Patrick, or did you go home? There he is. Check that out. He wore a tie for the first time ever today for this. Okay, my son Patrick Ward is in a Seattle public school. He has science. When you're teaching 9-year-olds, you can't teach science. Science is a verb. It is not a noun. I think that's really important. Science is a verb. And all we have time to teach in middle school are facts that science has come up with. But we can't teach how to do science in a middle school or a grade school. Now, they want to teach the controversy. How in the world, when you can't even teach real science in a grade school, are you going to have a 9-year-old like Patrick Ward try to balance a political point of view with a very complex methodological construct, one of the greatest the human mind has ever come up with, which is this verb we call science? It can't be done. If we teach the controversy, we remove the amount of time that Patrick Ward gets to hear about really important things, like biology, like DNA, like astronomy, and we put it in the realm of politics. We change a science class to a politics class. Now, let's say that every public school in America, as these folks want, teaches intelligent design, politics, next to science. What are American students like? How do they compete with the Chinese? How do they compete with the Europeans and the Japanese who don't do this? What do we do if we tell students the answer to that question is way too complex, forget about it, we kill curiosity? This will be my only heat at this point. Intelligent design taught in our schools will kill curiosity. And we become a nation of second raters.
Okay.
Think about this.
Steve, can you, there's been controversy even about what does it mean to teach controversy. What does it mean when Discovery Institute says that?
I don't think teaching... first of all, one thing Peter and I agree about is that science is full of controversies. And our proposal for science education, which I've made with my Darwinist colleague, former UW professor John Angus Campbell, is that teaching arguments and teaching arguments in science is a very good way to teach science, because one of the things that scientists do, one of the most important things that scientists do, is they argue about competing interpretations of the same evidence. And in Darwin's book, in The Origin of Species, Darwin says that he's making one long argument. And contemporary neo-Darwinism, which is indeed a biological perspective, makes many of the same arguments, but they're updated. And it turns out if you survey the biological literature, whether you're talking about the evidence from the fossil record, the evidence of molecular or anatomical homology, the evidence from biogeography, the evidence for the causal efficacy of natural selection acting on random mutation, there are evidence-based counterarguments to most of the main arguments that are made in the neo-Darwinian synthesis. So what we think that this doesn't kill curiosity. This it opens the door to
but
curiosity.
But it does. It says it's so complex.
No. And another thing we're not advocating that the theory of intelligent design be required in the public schools. We're trying to develop a scientific research program. We funded a lot of research. Most of the key books that have been produced in the early phases of work on intelligent design were funded by our institute. Our proposal is that students should learn the scientific case for Darwinian evolution in its modern and full glory, but they should also learn the scientific arguments against the theory as they appear in the scientific literature. The Cambrian explosion is a serious challenge to the idea of a seamless development of life.
No, not even
at
least.
40 body plans that emerge suddenly in the fossil record.
And we can simply with Hox genes. I teach this one of the lectures
that's
in my class.
That's very controversial, whether Hox genes.
No,
that's
not
exactly,
in the least.
That's a perfect illustration of what we're saying.
3 weeks from now, I'll give that lecture. Please come. I will convert you. It'll be...
I
turn
know
to the
Hox.
Darwin side. My first convert.
He's inviting me to join the dark side again.
Like, yeah, it's the light side. Look at this suit, man.